Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, with a heat advisory in effect and temperatures soaring toward dangerous highs, officials are urging the public to take precautions, especially when it comes to kids and cars. The inside of a vehicle can turn deadly fast. Radio Catskill's Patricia Robayo speaks with a safety expert from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Chronic wasting disease has been detected in a captive deer in Wayne County, triggering new hunting restrictions and concerns for the region's deer population. Reporter Liam Mayo from the River Reporter joins us to explain. In the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Cats Cast podcast, we'll discover how a 19th century artist's floral paintings are blooming anew as tattoos, and the All Things Good Festival returns. That's all coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Investigators are learning more about the man that walked into a midtown Manhattan office building with an automatic weapon yesterday and killed four people before killing himself. New York City Mayor Eric Adams says it appears he may have picked that building because of one of its tenants.
We have reason to believe that he was focused on the NFL agency that was located in the building. And we're going to continue to investigate with our federal partners.
Adams was interviewed on MSNBC's Morning Joe. He said the 27-year-old man from Las Vegas was carrying a note saying he blamed his mental illness on playing football, and the NFL doesn't do enough to protect players from the effects of head injuries. He said police also found an additional weapon in a car that was parked outside. As Israel faces growing international calls to let more food into Gaza, it's also facing a renewed push for a two-state solution. NPR's Air Petraoui reports.
France and Saudi Arabia co-chaired a conference at the UN calling for a two-state solution. It comes after France said it will recognize the state of Palestine, joining more than 100 countries that have already done so. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said at the conference a two-state solution is more remote now than ever.
The creeping annexation of the occupied West Bank is illegal. It must stop. The wholesale destruction of Gaza is intolerable. It must stop.
But he said these grim realities are why a two-state solution is needed. Many countries participated in the meeting, but Israel and the U.S. did not. Israel's ambassador to the U.N. said the conference's organizers were engaging in discussions disconnected from reality. Aya Batraoui, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a drop in the nation's trade deficit last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the market is now mixed.
The nation's trade gap narrowed in June to $86 billion. Exports and imports both fell during the month, but imports dropped more. Procter & Gamble says it expects President Trump's tariffs will cost the company about $1 billion this year. The maker of Tide laundry detergent and Pampers diapers plans to raise prices as a result. The IMF has slightly raised its forecast for global economic growth, saying while tariffs are a drag on the world economy, the damage may not be as bad as feared this spring. Two of the country's big freight railroads are proposing a merger that would allow cargo to go from coast to coast on the same corporate track. Union Pacific wants to buy Norfolk Southern in a deal valued at $85 billion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The market remains mixed. At this point, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 17 points. The S&P 500 is up 8 points. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says North Korea will not give up its nuclear weapons. Kim Yo-jong is believed to speak for her brother. She says North Korea's nuclear capability has sharply increased and it's not interested in talks on denuclearization. She says her brother's relationship with Trump is, in her words, not bad, but that can't be used to get North Korea to end its nuclear weapons program. As Americans struggle with high rent and home prices, more states are trying to force cities to build more affordable housing. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The median-priced home in Utah has spiked to more than $500,000, which only a sliver of renters could afford, says the governor's housing advisor, Steve Waldrop.
We're stopping young people from creating wealth.
Utah requires cities to pick a handful of ways to encourage denser, cheaper housing, but city planners say it can be hard to convince developers, and some local officials have been voted out for supporting too much density. Renter Grace Cunningham says she may end up leaving the state.
I am a young woman born and raised in Utah, and I am being priced out of my hometown.
And that breaks her heart. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
20 states and the District of Columbia are suing the Agriculture Department over its demand that it be given the personal data of tens of millions of people enrolled in SNAP, the food assistance program. The information includes addresses, birth dates, and social security numbers. The government says it needs this to check for waste and fraud. The lawsuit says this violates state and federal privacy laws. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. A heat advisory is in effect today from 11 this morning through 8 p.m. tomorrow for central New York counties, including Broome, Sullivan, Tompkins counties, and in northeast Pennsylvania, including Wayne and Pike counties. Heat index values could reach up to 99 degrees, making it feel dangerously hot. Stay cool and safe, drink plenty of water, avoid direct sun, stay in air-conditioned spaces, and check on neighbors, especially the elderly or those without AC. And with these searing summer temperatures, safety experts are urging parents and caregivers to take precautions to prevent child hot car deaths. These tragic incidents are the leading cause of non-crash vehicle-related fatalities for children 14 and under. Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio spoke with Laura Dunn, a highway safety specialist with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, about how quickly a car can become deadly, even on a mild day, and what we can all do to prevent these tragedies.
So unfortunately, so far in 2025, we've lost 15 children to hot car deaths. That's about an average of, we see about an average of 37 children die per year this way. In 2024, we lost 39 children from hot car deaths. And since 1998, more than 1,000 kids have died because they were left in a hot car, either intentionally or accidentally, or gained access to a car and couldn't get out. So this is something that keeps happening, that we want to do everything we can to prevent, because all these deaths are really tragic.
National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration is a campaign's message this year is stop, lock, and look. Can you sort of walk us through what that message means and how can it help parents and caregivers build, life-saving habits when they leave the car?
Yeah, of course. Our campaign message reminds parents of that life-saving message. Once you park, you should stop, look, and lock. So before leaving your car, stop, look in the back seat for your child, and then lock. And keep your doors locked also so a child can't get into your car and then become trapped.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed that a lot of the GPS apps out there now have, when I reach my destination, it automatically sends me alerts saying to please check behind me and check the back seat.
Yeah, and some vehicle OEMs have integrated some of those kind of back seat reminders into some of the newer vehicles. I know I myself noticed it when I rented a car recently, that it gave me a check the back seat reminder. So there are newer technologies that are coming onto the market that, you know, we are studying and trying to evaluate, you know, what's most effective and, you know, what works the best for people.
Now, heat stroke doesn't only happen, you know, during record-breaking heat. How quickly can a car heat up and become dangerous? And why are children, you know, particularly vulnerable, even on days that don't feel like dangerously hot?
I'm glad that you brought that up. So we have seen hot car deaths in temperatures as low as 60 degrees outside. And that's because in just 10 minutes, the inside of your car can heat up by about 20 degrees. And cracking a window or parking in the shade does very little to help. And it really only takes a few minutes for a car to become deadly hot it just keeps getting hotter and hotter, kind of like a greenhouse effect. Children are especially susceptible to this because their bodies can't regulate temperature like an adult can. Their body temperature rises about 3 to 5 times faster than an adult. So it just becomes a dangerous situation for them very quickly. So we just really encourage people to never leave your child unattended in a car for any amount of time.
As you were talking, it took me back to a couple of stories I heard in the past about, you know, parents or caregivers going to work, you know, rushing and literally forgetting their kid in the back. And so that's something you've mentioned, you know, the common scenarios that lead to heart car deaths, with, you know, forgotten, gained access, and left behind. Can you explain these three types of incidences and why each of them requires a sort of different kind of awareness and prevention?
So for the forgotten issue, we have found over the years that one of the biggest risk factors is a change in routine. So many of these deaths have happened, for example, because that morning routine is different for whatever reason. You know, a parent is maybe taking that child to childcare who normally doesn't. Maybe there was some sort of appointment. Something is different about that day. And nearly half of those kind of forgotten heat stroke deaths happen when that child is supposed to be dropped off at school or at childcare. And that momentary lapse in attention or memory can really happen to anyone. So in this scenario, something that is kind of referred to as your habit memory kind of overtakes, you know, your prospective or, you know, current time memory. And, you know, if you have ever been driving home from work and you intended to stop at the grocery store, and then for whatever reason, you just found yourself in your own driveway and you didn't stop at the grocery store. Kind of a similar phenomenon that you just kind of lose awareness, you know, of your child in that car at that time because the habit part of your brain has kind of taken over and taken you straight to work is what we've seen in some of these fatalities. So that's why we encourage folks to integrate that stop, look, lock routine into their everyday life. So it's something that you're doing habitually and you're always checking in that backseat as part of your everyday routine with your child.
Yeah. And you mentioned something that I actually, be honest with you, didn't even think of, and which is having a kid climb into a car when no one's noticing. You know, I live in a very rural area that sometimes I don't lock my car. I live in a very secluded area.
Yeah.
So it's common for me not to lock my car. What advice do you have for families, you know, about securing their vehicles to prevent children from gaining access on their own?
Yeah. About a quarter of all heat stroke deaths happen when a child gets into a vehicle on their own and then they're unable to get out. You know, a lot of times they want to play in the car for whatever reason, or they're playing a game like hide and seek. So it's really important to lock your car when you leave and put those keys and key fobs up and out of reach of children. Have that conversation with your children that a car is just never a safe place to play. This also goes for if you don't have children of your own. I would get into that habit of locking your car in your driveway, in your garage, to prevent neighborhood children from gaining access to your vehicle. Unfortunately, that's a scenario that we've seen as well, where children in the neighborhood would gain access to someone else's vehicle and then become trapped and overcome and become a hot car death.
Now, in the campaign, the Ad Council campaign, it sort of pushes back on the assumption that you know, that some folks could say, oh, that can never happen to me. How can I forget my child? But if you want to explain, you know, why is it important for parents and caregivers to, you know, acknowledge that it can happen to anyone?
It is important to recognize that this is a phenomenon that doesn't have any kind of clear, it doesn't happen to just some types of parents. It happens to all types of parents, loving and attentive parents. It happens to anybody. So it's important to kind of reinforce that, you know, we all have, you know, human memory systems that at times fail, which is why it's so important to make that stop, look, lock routine just habit. And, you know, part of how you can do that also, and we had talked about this when we talk about our tips for parents, is when you're going somewhere for the day, you know, you're doing that commute in the morning or going somewhere with your child, make sure that you put something that you need for the rest of your day in your back seat. So have it be your purse, your cell phone, your badge for work, your lunch, whatever you need for the rest of that day. make sure you place it in the back seat. So when you get to that destination, you have to park, you have to open that back door physically and look in your back seat to get your stuff and also to make sure that your children aren't in the back seat. I know I'm a parent of small children, and I know sometimes, especially on a warm day, you know, my children might fall asleep in the back seat also. So they're quiet, and it just adds to the factors of, you know, how a parent can lose awareness of a child being in a car, kind of all those factors together. So that's why we want to reinforce to create that stop, park, look, lock routine for folks.
Laura, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about the situation?
Yeah, I do want to say that if you are ever out in public and you see a child left in a car, if you see them in distress in a vehicle, act. Call 911 immediately. Call 911 immediately. Get them help. Every minute does count for children who are left in hot cars. And, you know, your intervention really could make all the difference for a child that's in distress. So don't hesitate. Call 911. Get that child help as soon as you can.
Absolutely. Well, we're talking to Laura Dunn, a highway safety specialist from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, talking about heat strokes and of children, how we could prevent this tragedy happening for hot car deaths. So, Laura, thank you so much for joining me on the program. I do really appreciate it.
And thanks to Liam Mayo for that report. Next is Liam Mayo from the River Reporter, who's joining us to explain how chronic wasting disease detected in deer in Wayne County could impact the local economy and what hunters need to know moving forward. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
When you walk into NPR headquarters, one of the first things you see is a big map of the country covered with little blue dots. Each dot represents a local public radio station. That's the NPR network. I'm Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. With federal funding for public media eliminated, your network is under serious threat. Help us plan for the road ahead by giving to this station today. Thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Chronic wasting disease, a fatal neurological illness that affects deer, has been detected in a captive deer in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. In response, state officials have established a new disease management area, or DMA 10, covering several townships in the northern part of the county. To help us understand what this means for local hunters, residents, and the region's economy, we're joined live by the River Reporter's news editor, Liam Mayo, who's been covering the story in depth. And he'll also tell us about a new trail in Hawley that completes a long-awaited connection between Lake Wallenpaupack and the historic D&H Canal Park. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
So let's talk with start with this chronic wasting disease. For those who may not be familiar, what is chronic wasting disease and why is it so concerning?
Yeah, chronic wasting disease is a, as you mentioned, a fatal neurological condition that affects members of the deer family. It's caused by a misshapen protein known as a prion. I think the more like commonly known cousin of that disease is mad cow disease, which is a similar like prion disease except for cows. This one affects deer. It spreads through animal-to-animal contact or through sort of contaminated environments. And the reason it's been concerning is it's been spreading slowly across the country in ways that have been difficult to stop or eradicate. It was first found in Colorado. It was found in a captive deer in 1967 and in a free-ranging elk in 1981. And it's been spreading kind of east since then. Pennsylvania's first cases of CWD were in 2012. And, you know, due to the fact that we're talking about it in Wayne County now in 2025, you can get the impression that there have been things done to slow the spread of the disease, but it has still been spreading across the country.
And when was this case first detected in Wayne County?
Yeah, this case was detected early this year. The disease management area was established back in April. And it was detected in a single captive deer. in northeastern Wayne County. And this disease management area was established. And when we talked to a representative from the Pennsylvania Game Commission, he really wanted to emphasize that, like, that it was a found in a single captive deer. And then that makes it a little bit different from some of the other cases of CWD that have been found in the Commonwealth. This disease management area that the Game Commission has established, this one up in Wayne County, is the 10th disease management area. Most of the other ones in Pennsylvania have, like, only spread since their initial, creation. So CWD will be detected in a deer, and this disease management area is established, and it just kind of has to keep being maintained to try and contain the spread of the disease, but the disease itself is not eradicated. But the first disease management area established in Pennsylvania was found in a captive population, and that disease management area has since been eradicated. Basically, they took the area where it was found, or the area around the captive population it was found in. They quarantined it for like 5 years, and then they didn't detect any further instances of CWD, so they declared that case closed. So I think that's something they wanted to make clear, that like that's a definite potential future for Wayne County. It's not because it hasn't hit the wild population yet, or it's not like been found in the wild population yet. It's not necessary that it will be something Wayne County has to deal with for the indefinite future. It could be that same kind of situation where the area goes under management for like 5 years and then is declared free of CWD.
So disease management area 10 is here in Northeast Pennsylvania in Wayne County. What are the townships that are included in DMA 10? And there are some restrictions now in place for hunters within DMA 10 in Wayne County.
Yeah, the townships involved are all of Manchester Township and parts of Buckingham, Preston, Mount Pleasant, Lebanon, and Damascus. We published the map with the areas, but it's also found in kind of interactive form on the Pennsylvania Game Commission website. The Game Commission will sort of itself be spreading awareness and some of the more specific regulations around this that hunters have to look out for. At the high level, hunters can't remove like quote unquote high risk parts from a DMA. This would be the head, the spinal column, the spleen, like the bits of the deer where CWD kind of concentrates. But hunting is still permitted within a DMA, and it's actually part of the DMA management strategy to encourage hunting.
So they encourage that. It's considered part of the solution to managing CWD.
Yeah, and the Game Commission will also offer free testing for hunters where they can drop the heads of the deer off and get those tested to make sure that the deer they've taken doesn't contain CWD. Apparently, CWD is not known to infect humans. So in theory, it would be okay to eat meat from a deer that had CWD, but it's just better not to risk it, and the CDC recommends against it. So for a hunter to be able to test their deer to just make sure that it doesn't contain CWD, that's something like that's good for peace of mind, and just to make sure that there's nothing that could possibly go wrong there.
Have you heard from the local hunting community so far about this news and the new rules or potential economic or cultural impacts in Wayne County, especially given how important hunting is to the local area and businesses?
Yeah, we talked with game farmer Adam Hill from Wayne County, and he told us that he was just very concerned about it, in part because this disease has been so hard to control across the country. And the things that have been put in place, like these disease management areas, have slowed it. They haven't really stopped it. So the fact that it's here now, even if it is just for now in this captive population, it's incredibly concerning. But the other thing he told us is that, like, northern Wayne County especially is kind of, he used the word, like, an oasis for deer hunting, with a lot of deer hunting clubs. He said that, quote, it's hard to find a family who doesn't hunt deer here in Wayne County, unquote. So, even if it is contained for now, or even if hunting is still like allowed for now, or if hunting is absolutely still allowed with this DMA, but like the fact that CWD is here is still very concerning to the local hunting population. And that hunting population is a fairly significant chunk of the population of Wayne County.
And besides hunters, should residents or anyone in the region be aware of anything moving forward here?
I think the main non-hunting one that we've found so far is that you're not supposed to feed deer within a CWD.
That's a good general rule anyway.
Yeah. But no, primarily the restrictions focus on hunting deer and that kind of thing.
And you can read Liam's full reporting on this at riverreporter.com. Want to also get to another story you've been covering, the new 1.6-mile trail in Hawley that completes the long-awaited connection between Lake Wallenpaupack and the historic D&H Canal Park at Lock 31. What makes this trail so significant and this completion such a big milestone?
Yeah, so this is a bit of happier outdoors Pennsylvania news for you today. It's a 1.6-mile trail running through property around the Lake Wallenpaupack Dam that's owned by the company that runs the dam, Brookfield Renewable. And it is one of the last pieces or a major piece of like a 40-year, multi-decade push from members of the community to build trails in Wayne and Pike counties. I think we talked about it a couple months ago in relation more to the river access points that this initiative has created in Honesdale and sort of further along the Lackawaxen River. But this is part of that as well. And what this trail does is, like you said, it forms the final link in kind of a loose network of trails that has been built over the past couple of decades. So there's sort of two trails closer to the Lake Wallenpaupack area. There's the Lake Wallenpaupack Trail and then the Wallenpaupack Creek Trail, which kind of goes from Lake Wallenpaupack down into the forest along some of the like major pipes that run away from the dam. And the Gorge Trail takes where that previous trail ended and completes the connection to like downtown Hawley. It doesn't quite drop you off right in downtown Hawley, but it's a fairly short walk, if I'm getting my geography correct, from where the trail gets out into Hawley. And then you have access to Hawley, you have access to the parks, the public parks that are in Hawley, like the Riverside Park. And if you kind of keep going on another trail, you will, as you mentioned, eventually end up at the D&H Canal Park, which is about halfway between Hawley and Honesdale on the Lackawaxen River. So the fact that this trail is in place now is a bit of a culmination of like 40 plus years of work and some of the like longtime volunteers in the area who have been pushing for trails in the area and for this trail in particular were there to sort of celebrate this as that. But then it's also, you know, potentially something that could even get connected all the way up to Honesdale in the future. So it's a major milestone, but it's definitely not the end of trail building efforts in the area.
Yeah, it seems strange that it took 40 years. What was the opposition to the trail? Like, it seems like, you know, people would want to have a trail to walk around in nature.
Oh, I may be overstating that or misstating that a little bit. It's not that 40 years ago someone sort of filed the first permit application for this trail and it took 40 years to make it through the permitting. Government doesn't move quite that slowly for something like this.
Are you sure?
At least in this case, it's more that like there have been through the past couple decades a feeling that we need trails generally in the area. And the idea of this kind of trail was part of that, but there wasn't really any of this trail infrastructure right. in place 40 years ago. So the past 40 years has been building all of the sort of trails and the parks and the river accesses that we've been talking about that this trail is now joining and helping connect between. So it's 40 years of work that has resulted in all of this interconnection of river access and public access to nature. So yeah. Not just this one particular trail.
Well, you also have a photo in your article of Grant Genslinger, a member of the Lackawanna River Trails, who originated this idea with others in the mid-80s. So it was great to see this come full circle. You can read all about the trail and, of course, about the reporting of chronic wasting disease detected in a captive deer in Wayne County and what that all means at therivereporter.com. Leah Mayo, the news editor of The River Reporter, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll have the latest excerpt of CatsCast, the CatsCast podcast with Brett Berry. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we speak with one of the smartest and most compelling people in contemporary theater.
David Adjemi is my name, and playwright is my game.
We talk about what it costs to lead a creative life these days.
There were times when I really thought I was losing my mind. It got really, really bad for me.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now joining us is Brett Berry, host and producer of the CatsCast podcast, to dive into a fascinating story of art, history, and reinvention. The latest episode of the CatsCast podcast focuses on Emily Cole. She's the daughter of Hudson River School founder Thomas Cole, and she's being celebrated today through a unique collaboration between the Thomas Cole National Historic Site and Hummingbird Tattoo. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Well, this is a I'm good, and this is a modern twist on some 19th century artistry. Tell us a little bit more about Emily Cole and her art and how this combination of the Thomas Cole National Historic Site and Hummingbird Tattoo came to be.
Yeah, well, someone at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site had a good idea to involve some community members in their latest exhibit, which is about the art of Emily Cole, who was the daughter of Thomas Cole, who most of us know as the father of the Hudson River School of Painting. And Emily Cole was an artist in her own right and painted china, so porcelain, and had all kinds of intricate and natural flower motifs that she became very well known for and was known as the China painter of Catskill or the Catskills. So, you know, well respected in her time, and then kind of fell off a little bit. And most of us remember her dad, but not so much her. So the museum has an exhibit of her work right now through November 2nd. And they recruited some community partners like Hummingbird Tattoo, which is kind of a really cool part of this story.
Yeah. Who are we talking to in this excerpt here?
Okay, so it starts off with the proprietor of Hummingbird Tattoo in Catskill, which is only about a mile from the Thomas Cole Historic Site. And then we also speak with an associate curator of this exhibit at the Thomas Cole Museum.
Yeah, I love how you discover such great things, CatsCast, the Catskills podcast. This is an excerpt of that with Brett Berry. Brett, thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
I actually knew nothing about Emily Cole, which was surprising to me because
In college, I actually took an art history course that covered Thomas Cole and the Hudson Valley River School.
Kelsey Liu is the proprietor of Hummingbird Tattoo in Catskill, where we met her at a pop-up event celebrating the work of Emily Cole, daughter of Thomas Cole, and known in her time as the Catskill China Painter. Personally, I'm a bit shy around needles, so I was apprehensive about visiting a tattoo shop and witnessing the process firsthand. But Hummingbird is a welcoming and immaculate space, and Kelsey Liu is a creative professional with a calming presence.
I am from the area. I grew up in Saugerties. I went to school in Saugerties. I studied visual arts and education at SUNY New Paltz. That's where I kind of developed my love of art. I did love teaching. I taught elementary art, but it just wasn't really for me. I did really appreciate that job because it gave me the ability and the freedom to pursue my other interests, and that's where I found tattooing. I was able to have the resources to teach myself how to tattoo about 5 years ago. Eventually, I was confident enough in my clientele and in my skills to go full time. At that time, I had just a private studio. And from there, it just grew. My clientele grew, my experience grew, my love for the art grew, and I decided to leave teaching and go full time tattooing. Then I decided to come to Catskill and move into this space. And that's where Hummingbird was born.
Tell me a little bit about this collaboration with the Thomas Cole site. How did that happen?
So Beth, the education coordinator at Thomas Cole site, reached out to me a few months ago. She was very passionate about the project, and her passion definitely inspired me. We went through the museum. She showed me some of Emily's work. I was able to photograph some of the work myself, spend time with it. I spent about a month with the work before I even started drawing.
Had you heard of Emily Cole, or what did you know about her before Beth reached out?
I actually knew nothing about Emily Cole, which was surprising to me because in college, I actually took an art history course that covered Thomas Cole and the Hudson Valley River School. And Emily Cole was never mentioned in that, which was surprising to me. You know, women deserve a place in history just as much as men, and her work really stands out and is so beautiful. So I'm really grateful for Thomas Cole site for taking this time to put together this curation of her work and give her a voice in this space as well.
Do you see any parallels between how tattoos may not be seen as high art and how Emily Cole was advocating for ceramic art to be seen as high art? Is there a link through time between you and Emily in that way?
I absolutely feel that way so strongly. I feel that there's a lot of camaraderie between her and I and the parallels of time. I think not only are art forms being seen as less than ceramics and tattooing in the past, and it's growing now and there's more space for both of these, but definitely through time people have struggled with these art forms. Even now in some spaces, tattooing is not seen as fine art, it's not seen as an art form at all. But luckily, I live in a nice little bubble where the people that I have the privilege of working with do appreciate my work and do see it as art.
How did you decide which of Emily's designs to adapt into a tattoo for today's event? And what is that process like? How do you take something like that and make that adaptation?
Like I said, I was able to walk through the Thomas Cole site and take some photos on my own of some of her objects, some of her watercolor paintings. And I really resonated with those that I could see in person and see with my own eyes. And I sat with them for about a month, and I kept them very similar to her original designs because, one, I wanted to honor her in that way, but two, we have very similar styles, and her botanical illustrations are just so beautiful as is, and that feminine delicacy that reads through is like very similar to what I already draw on my own in tattoo. So it was a very easy transition to take her work and make it into my own.
Emily Cole's 19th century watercolor of a thistle was the basis for a tattoo design that attracted Jamie Pedersen to the shop.
Hi, my name is Jamie Pedersen, and I'm here to get a tattoo from Kelsey. So I've known about the tattoo shop for a while, and I've been wanting to get a tattoo, so I saw the event that's happening today on Instagram.
Is it appropriate to ask how many tattoos you have already?
Yeah, just three. Oh, wait, no, four. This one that we're adding to, yeah.
What do you know about Emily Cole?
Nothing.
Okay.
And local, 19th century, that's about as far as my knowledge goes, though.
Lucky for us, Emily Cole experts are within a mile of Hummingbird, just up the road at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site. So as Jamie settles in for her thistle tattoo...
All right, are you ready?
Yep.
I'm going to start with just a little line just so you can feel the spot.
It's off to Emily Cole's house.
Feel okay?
Yep.
Just a mile from Hummingbird Tattoo in Catskill, we joined Associate Curator Amanda Malmstrom at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site, where Emily Cole's art is on exhibit, including the very watercolor that inspired Jamie Pedersen's tattoo.
Yes, I am Amanda Malmstrom. I'm Associate Curator here at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill, New York, in the curatorial department working on exhibitions, publications, and displays here at the Historic Site and Museum.
Could you refresh all of our memories on the importance of Thomas Cole to the art world and also tell us about the women who inhabited this place?
Of course. We are the historic home of Thomas Cole, who is often cemented in our Art History 101 books as the father of the Hudson River School or the founder of American landscape painting, which we complicate and trouble here at the Thomas Cole site, but is an artist who really found inspiration here in the landscapes of the Hudson River Valley and Catskill Mountains, putting paintbrush to canvas and also pen to paper, thinking about the industrialization he witnessed firsthand happening in the area. So we interpret him as a proto-environmentalist who used art and writing to push back against unfettered development here in the Hudson Valley.
And this house was actually owned by his wife or his wife's family?
Yes. This house was built in 1815 by the Thompson family. By the time Thomas Cole comes here for the first time in 1825, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of that trip this year, Maria Bartow was living here, who was the niece of the owner of the house. Cole is renting a cottage next door, eventually falls in love and marries Maria Bartow and moves into the house. So this home was actually never owned by Thomas, even though the name, you know, he is our namesake. This home was always kind of run, owned, and stewarded by women. So Thomas Cole moved in here 1836. They would go on to have four children, two sons and two daughters. Emily Cole being one of those daughters, she was the only one of their four children to really continue the legacy of her father, becoming a professional artist in her own right, but being known as, quote, Catskill's China painter, who sold, exhibited her painted flowers on China wares. Emily Cole was only 5 years old when her father passed away, but I like to imagine if they had truly been able to spend more time together that Emily and Thomas would have talked about art, would have gone on sketching trips as well together. But we do see in Emily's work the influence of her father, even though they never spent considerable amount of time together.
She was five when he died, so you could say maybe some of it passed genetically, but what was her formal training?
Yes, she was a student at the National Academy of Design, which was actually co-founded by her father in New York City. So even though, yes, she was only 5 years old when her father passed away, seems to have had some sort of support kind of indirectly through her father. She would have also grown up surrounded by her father's paintings in the house, in the new studio. Knowing that your father was an artist perhaps encouraged this career. But also artists like Frederick Church, who was Thomas Cole's student, mentored Emily Cole. We have a letter that he writes to her after she expresses that she's not very satisfied with her artistic production in art school at this point. And Frederick Church said he was glad to hear it because that means she knows exactly where her defects are and she can improve. So she had mentorship from the most famous artist in her time. Frederick Church. So seems to have had this network of support through these Hudson River School circles.
Was the china sold as art pieces or as functional dinnerware?
Both. It kind of straddles both of those. It would have been probably the nice china that you would have at your home that you would display in your cabinets. Maybe you would bring out for your most esteemed guests. This work is fine art, and that's really true to the historic story as well. Emily Cole was a founding member of the New York Society of Ceramic Arts in 1892, and this was a group of mostly women who advocated that ceramic artworks, china painting, are fine art and really should be displayed in museums and galleries as fine art. You know, you still go to museum galleries today and the china and the ceramics are in hallways and these gold-framed oil paintings get their due on the center of these gallery walls. But we really want to kind of complicate that and really present these ceramic installations by Emily Cole, but also our eight contemporary artists as fine art and as art worthy of contemplation and spending time with.
Do you know how Emily Cole's work was received during her lifetime?
Yes, we do. Through some archival research, we have exhibition reviews of her work, which is fantastic. But critics have called her work highly prized and much sought after. They've kind of talked about her flowers as being really successful in that they're very naturalistic. And one critic said that her flowers, even though cemented on porcelain, seemed to live and breathe the soft air, which I feel like is a lovely description of her work and shows that she's really painting these flowers from direct observation. And I feel like that's really taking a page out of her father's artistic mantra of going out into nature, looking with your eyes, sketching, and really trying to communicate some sort of truth to what nature presents to us.
Could you describe in your own words how you feel Emily depicted the flowers? What was her style, if it was unique in some way?
Totally. I think her work is definitely unique to her own hand, her own worlds that surrounded her, being living here at the home of her father, being surrounded by the Catskill Mountains, definitely inspired by the Hudson River School style of artwork. Her work is very naturalistic. Her flower stems might bend in the wind. There's a petal missing, perhaps from a rainstorm that passes through. She doesn't always paint the flowers in their, quote, ideal state. Perhaps they're turning away from the viewer. Perhaps they are just a bud and actually haven't bloomed yet. So she really seems to be interested in cycles of life, cycles of floral bloom. And she really seems to follow these ideas of John Ruskin, who was so influential to the Hudson River School painters, 19th century artists, who really said that young artists need to sketch from nature, go outside. Her flowers, even though beautiful and enticing, they're not perfect. And so she really seems to sketch what she truly saw outside. They seem to be these floral portraits that capture the unique qualities of a single bloom, whether that be like a tear on a petal or a missing leaf or a bud or even a stem that the bloom has fallen, really seems to be illustrating not an ideal bloom on every plate.
Did she have her own family, and how long did she live in this house?
She was a lifelong resident here at what was known historically as Cedar Grove. She never married, never had kids, but seemed to be a really integral member of her immediate family who lived here. She eventually became the owner of the home and lived here with her siblings and her nieces and nephews, which we know she gave kind of informal china painting lessons to. So she was living here when she passed away at 70 years old in 1913.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
70 for that time.
And yeah. She was painting artwork up until, you know, at least 1910. So she really had many decades being active as a flower painter and china painter.
You know Emily Cole better than most people. Do you think she would sign up for a tattoo?
You know, I like to think that she would. You know, she really seemed to have this deep affinity and love of flowers. Yeah, I like to think that she would. I don't know which bloom was her favorite, but I like to think about, you know, maybe if she was a member of the 21st century, she would be signing up and getting in line.
Back at Hummingbird, where Kelsey was wrapping up that thistle tattoo, I asked her the same question.
Do you think that Emily Cole would get a tattoo if she were here today?
I would like to think so. I think that she seemed to be a very outgoing and sort of paving the way kind of person. So I think she would have definitely come in and gotten one of these tattoos for sure.
Emily Cole's originals are on exhibit through November 2nd. More on that exhibit at thomascole.org. And more about those tattoos on Instagram at Hummingbird Catskill. For Radio Catskill and CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, this is Brett Barry.
Thanks to Brett for that. And you can hear the full episode and all of the episodes of CatsCast at catscast.com. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, it's the All Things Good Festival returning. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Ira Flatow from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A unique celebration of healing, justice, and joy is coming to Sullivan County. All Things Good 2025. It's more than just a festival. It's a gathering rooted in wellness, grief, and collective action. With the theme, Wander into Wellness, Grieving, Healing, and Organizing as a Community, this year's event brings together sound healing, yoga, poetry, protest training, and live music. Joining us is Ariana Kaminsky, the visionary organizer behind All Things Good, to tell us more about the inspiration and the movement behind the festival. Ariana, hello. Welcome back.
Hey, Tim. So good to see you again.
Thank you for joining us again. Tell folks, for those who may be hearing about the All Things Good Festival for the first time, what's it all about? What's it all about to you?
Yeah, totally. So it is our fifth year, and it was born out of my existential dread, which I'm sure many of us can relate to. Living in this current day and age can be really overwhelming, and it can feel like, what can I actually do to make a difference? And that's what this festival is designed for. It's designed for any human who wants to make the world a better place to live. And so I design every aspect of this festival to do just that. And especially, like you mentioned, our theme this year of grieving, healing, and organizing. We are going to have installations and workshops that help facilitate grieving, healing, and quite literally organizing, learning about our First Amendment rights, de-escalation tactics, how to navigate what life is throwing at us right now.
So is that what inspired the focus of the theme this year? What life is throwing at you?
Believe it or not, I was inspired for this theme like around last fall, just intuitively. Uh-huh. And I was already planning this protesting workshop. And then lo and behold, life is unraveling the way it is. And I couldn't think of anything more perfect.
Can you walk folks through what they can expect over the course of the main event weekend at New Memories?
Totally, yes. So the main event is August 9th and 10th at New Memories in Parksville. There is too much that I cannot explain all of it, but there are some highlights, including the Climate Cafe we are having on Saturday with Gail King from Extinction Rebellion, where we are going to have an opportunity to process climate grief. We also have that Stand Up for Your Rights workshop with Alexis Danzig from ACT UP. We have a dance party with DJ Cat Silk. Sunday is our family day. 6 and under are free. 7 to 14 years old, only $10. And we have specific workshops for children. We have Our Bodies, Our Power, a movement-based, heart-centered workshop for young people to explore the power of their bodies, emotions, and voices. So that's it. But our biggest thing on the main event is a wedding. I have planned... I have a whole wedding package. I have the officiant who are Once Upon a Vow based out of Boston. We have Earth Girl Flowers donating the flowers. 2 nights stay at the Outlier Inn. 2 VIP tickets. I want to help wed a couple that are experiencing hardships right now, whether it's financial, immigration status issues, healthcare access, or even just protecting your LGBT rights. I need people to submit. I have it all planned out.
Why a wedding? What's you're so enthusiastic about all of it, but particularly the wedding.
Yeah, well, I think it's so important to create space that recognizes love and like hope in a period of such grief and disappointment.
Where can folks get more information about the wedding and then all of the events? You just skimmed the surface here.
I know, right? So please check out atgfestival.com or atgfestival on Instagram or TikTok. That's where you're going to find all the information. Also, we're having a pre-party this coming Saturday, August 2nd at Coshecton Pump House from 12 to 6. I'm going to be there. We're going to have henna. We're going to have tie-dye, live music by the Electric Chords at 3:30, a dance party by DJ Tikka Masala at 4:30, and it's going to be a time where I'll have more information and we can interact.
And what do you hope folks walk away from this festival with? I mean, there's a lot of different things. There's joy. You're processing grief. You're taking, what people may be feeling in the moment and giving folks a platform to express it in multiple ways. What do you want people to take away from this festival?
That's a great question. Aside from like healing, quite literally, but hope. Hope for the future and the fact that even though things can seem so scary and uncertain, that we have each other, we have community, and we have to live moment to moment by embracing the love and opportunity that exists all around us.
And how can listeners get involved, whether that's attending or volunteering or supporting in another way?
Yes. Well, we definitely could use support. It's called an ATG super supporter by helping. We have a list of different things, check-in attendant, helping set up installations. Email us. It's allthingsgoodfestival@gmail.com or just send a DM at ATG festival. And that's how you can get involved.
That's how the kids do it. They DM.
Exactly. DM.
Ariana Kaminsky is the organizer behind All Things Good 2025. More than just a festival, a gathering rooted in wellness and collective action. Thank you so much for being here and so much for organizing this yet again. Your smile and your energy is contagious.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear this program and all of our locally produced programming at our website, WJFFradio.org. While you're there, we are asking for your support as we continue to fill the gap now that federal funding has been taken away. Go to WJFFradio.org to help us stay strong, stay healthy, stay local, and bring you these great stories of the great people in our community. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the exotic sounds of the Bahama Soul Club and the Left Arm of Buddha, plus the unreleased Les Baxter. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Come join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. local news, culture, and NPR. There is a heat advisory in effect between now and 8 o'clock tomorrow. Temperatures could get up to 99 or higher. Drink plenty of fluids and stay inside and stay in air conditioning if you can. Check on folks who may not have air conditioning and also the vulnerable population, neighbors like elderly neighbors as well. Abundant sunshine, hot, humid, high 89. It's already 88 at our Liberty Studios, but the feels like temperature is at 96. Cloudy tonight, low 66. Partly cloudy and a stray thunderstorm possible tomorrow with a high of 87. Looking ahead in the forecast, it looks like it'll cool down on Thursday to 75 with thunderstorms, and Friday, high of 69. It's WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org, Radio Catskill. It's 11 o'clock.